Patrizia says it is also likely Bill Gates is a front man for the mob, as was Epstein. Mere money runners for the Hidden Hand. This is an excellent point. If you saw the film Casino, think of it. Philip Green, who's played by a great Jewish actor, whose name escapes me. He was also in A Few Good Men. He played Sam Weinberg in A Few Good Men. And he plays Philip Green in Casino. So he's the guy then that, to the public, it looks like he was given a loan from the Teamsters to buy the casino. Then we see Robert De Niro. Robert De Niro is going to be managing the casino. He's above Philip Green. Everybody thinks Philip Green is the boss, but he isn't. He's a nobody. Robert De Niro is Bill Gates, or Bill Gates is represented in the casino scenario by Bill Gates. Bill Gates isn't the boss. I mentioned this on the program last night. He's another capo regime for the mob. The real bosses, I believe in my heart of hearts, nobody, either on this program, who's ever been on this program, by the way, that includes Jim Mars and David Icke, nobody knows these people's names. These people are so hidden, they are almost completely unknown. The ones that call the shots. What David Icke has done over the years, which I find to be brilliant, is the spider's web, where you have the central control system in the middle, you have the ultimate hidden hand, and then you spread out then across the web to everything that we see, the banks, the financial institutions, the IMF, down to the think tanks, which give policies, which instruct governments and political parties what their policies should be. Governments don't come up with policies. You can't believe for a minute that a government of any era actually comes up with the policies that it takes to the House of Commons to be voted upon and then to be basically put into law. They don't, they get their ideas from think tanks. Where do the think tanks come from and who informs them? Anyway, loads to get through with Tony. Don't have to tell you anything about Tony Gosling you don't already know. Brilliant journalist, brilliant writer, great guy, The Politics Show, host, co-host, Tony likes to say. We are going to talk about Martin Bashir. We are going to talk about Belarus and what's going on there. We might talk a bit about Palestine, but we're going to kick off, of course, with Cummings. Let's welcome back to the programme, live from Bristol, my great friend Tony Gosling. That was a terrific speech you gave at that protest a couple of weeks back, Tony. Well done, my friend. I really enjoyed it.
Well, that's very kind of you, but, you know, my main problem is that so much of what we're dealing with today is the treachery of the mass media. Most of what we're being told, it's very much like, you know, when I was a kid, we were told stories of Soviet Russia, that the population had to have a kind of decoder inside their heads. It's very 1984, you know, where we've got to kind of figure out what the truth is and read between the lines the whole time, because people who are paid to share key, important life-saving information with us have just sold out to the pharmaceutical industry. Because they know, I think, you know, it's basically dog whistle stuff, that they know that if they start telling the truth, that they'll be out of their job in 5 minutes. Because the pharmaceutical lobby and the globalist lobby, and let me say also the Bilderberg lobby, because it's the Bilderberg social media that have been censoring the doctors as well as the mass media. You know, they've just been taking people like Tess Lorry, you know, in Bath from the evidence-based medicine consultancy she runs, off the internet again and again and again. And she is a qualified doctor, that she was saying that she delivered thousands of babies when over in... But apparently, we're not allowed to hear her opinion.
No. No, we're not. She has to come on a program like this to be heard in this country. She has to speak to somebody like you to be heard in this country. That's a wonderful thing, because you're a brilliant journalist. But as good as you are, and as much of a reach as you have and I have, it's nothing compared to the BBC or Sky News. So we bring her on and we talk to her and we challenge her and we let her speak. But, you know, it's nothing like if she goes on BBC Breakfast. It's treachery. Can I just say this before you go on? I was watching Sky News this morning at 6:10. There's a very young presenter on there now in the morning. Her name is Vanessa. And she's a charming woman, she is. She, you know, she's well presented and she can present. And she introduced the story today about strokes and AstraZeneca. This is how bad the media has become, Tony. She said to, she talked about the strokes in three people. And then she introduced some professor. It doesn't matter. It's one of the usual mob. Her first question to him was, "Welcome, professor," she said. "Now, it's important that we, mind, reassure people that this is very, very rare, isn't it?" Tony, that's fucking garbage. That's garbage. That's testifying. You're the journalist. It's up to you to ask him to prove that it's an anomaly and that it's rare. She said it's rare, isn't it? I mean, in your time in the BBC, you'd have been fired for that.
Well, I don't know if I'd have been fired for it. I'd certainly have had my knuckles wrapped when we came off air by my producer or my editor. Yeah. And, you know, actually what it is, it's collusion. So what you're doing is you're having somebody on who's been conning the public now for months and months. And what you're doing is you're just going along with it. You're not asking them any awkward questions.
No.
And this is the problem, is that the difficult questions aren't, it's not just they're not answered, because of course these people are quite good at maneuvering around questions. They're not even asked. And what we're getting is we're getting kids straight out of their O-level, you know, media studies or whatever, put onto national radio and television, whilst all the seasoned journalists around the country have slowly been, you know, squeezed off the airways.
Kicked out.
You know, so it is. It's treachery, and it's all in the aim of getting more and more and more of these vaccines out there, and effectively, you know, bamboozling the public into thinking, well, everyone must be doing it. I'm just getting opinions saying it's great. You know, we have almost, listening on talk radio yesterday, they've got adverts on there, which have got this kind of, you know, almost like sunshine music in the background. Oh, you know, have your vaccine.
Yeah.
It's going to be really lovely and wonderful. You know, this is a hard sell. And the reason I figured this out 2 weeks ago, Richie, I interviewed Dr. Stanley Laham from Florida University, who I've had on a few times.
Yeah, yeah.
And he is, he's a pro-Palestinian doctor, retired immunologist, spent his whole life in immunology. And he explained to me, he took me through, the last 10 years of the results of the flu vaccine, right? Nothing to do with COVID. This is just looking at the flu vaccine. And he explained that in 2018, it became absolutely clear from the statistics that the flu vaccine was not doing anything at all.
Nothing.
Despite the billions of pounds being spent on it to stop the flu. Nothing at all. And possibly even the opposite, you know. So it became absolutely clear statistically in 2018, the flu vaccine was a total failure. Now, what he was suggesting was, in order to obscure this fact, in other words, to stop the withdrawing of any public funding for flu vaccine, this is partly one of the reasons why there's been this massive push for the COVID vaccine. It's because the pharmaceutical industry know the flu vaccine has failed. It's about to be possibly withdrawn forever from the market for having failed. And so they need to, first of all, obscure that fact. And then secondly, double down by having another vaccine, which is possibly going to fail, in order to just keep their industry going. It's a bit like the nuclear industry. When we saw Fukushima and all the results of that, the money that's been piled into the nuclear industry, it became clear that the nuclear industry was a total disaster. So what did we do in this country? Oh, well, we introduced a whole new program of building new nuclear power stations, like Hinkley Point, just down the road in the North Somerset coast here. So these massive industries have got a momentum of cash, and they spend billions on keeping that industry going, however much of a failure it is. And exactly the same, I think, is true for the nuclear and the pharmaceutical industry when it comes to vaccines.
No doubt about it. Tony Gosling is our guest, thisweek.org.uk, live from Bristol. I watched an awful lot of Dominic Cummings today. And Mike, this is what I've deduced. I'll give it to you in 30 seconds and then you can take over. It's being painted, of course, by the media that this is revenge, that this is hell has no fury, like a senior advisor scorned. It's him getting his own back, having left Downing Street or being kicked out late last year. I see it completely differently. I see this as another brick in this big PSYOP wall. Cummings is selling. It's a hard sell today for lockdowns, for quick lockdowns, for longer lockdowns, for harder lockdowns, and for vaccines. That's what I see it as. But the media will present it as some sort of, you know, Dallas soap opera type JR against Bobby Ewing kind of a thing, when in reality this is carefully orchestrated. It's mind control over the public. The lockdowns are good. We should do them really early, really hard. Take your vaccines. That's how I see it. How do you see it, Tony?
Well, I mean, this time last year, we had 3 weeks of an attempt to get Dominic Cummings sacked by trial by media. Everything he said was a lie, a lie, a lie. The guy's a liar, a liar, a liar. This week, guess what? He's not a liar anymore.
That's right.
He tells the truth. He's a whistleblower. He's a, you know, what? I mean, put myself in his shoes, I think what's happening here is that he's been instructed by the deep state. Look, if you want to have any career in the future, if you want to actually go on to greater things, which we might even get a knighthood after this, you never know, you toe the line on X, Y, and Z, and, you know, then everyone will pat you on the back again. The idea that this guy is just, you know, there to just blow the whistle on what's been going on. As far as I know, this inquiry, right, it should have started on the big issues to do with the pandemic. Number one, the massive amounts of money that went into the totally failed models from John Hopkins University and Imperial College, from the Gates Foundation. Yeah. The massive amount of money that's gone into the revolving doors between the Wellcome Foundation and SAGE, people like Jeremy Farrar on SAGE, the total ignoring of these life-saving cures, which Tess estimates killed 60,000 people in the UK for not being introduced early on, the ivermectin particularly, which was being, you know, some doctors were saying this straight away, but nobody was listening. And more doctors have come on board with this, you know, looking at all the figures and the scant studies that have been done, because, of course, the pharmaceutical industry funds almost all the medical studies, and it doesn't want to fund ivermectin because it's not going to make any money out of it. So, I mean, this is the sort of thing I would have expected to be number one on the list in any kind of honest public inquiry done into this pandemic, is to let's have a look at the things we know have killed people, tens of thousands of people, not to have some sort of little cameo for the superstar Dominic Cummings, who magically, over a year, has turned from a serial liar into a superhero.
And nobody wanted to ask Cummings today, where was your conscience last June or July or August or September? Why didn't you blow the whistle then? You're apologising today for needless excess debts. Why didn't you blow the whistle sooner? It's so stage managed, it's almost untrue. Tony Gosling is our guest. Let's leave it alone for a moment, Tony. And let's talk about another story, which, fair play to you, I've been following, well, I do follow you on Twitter, but your tweets on the Martin Bashir saga are very incisive, I think. And this is a very important story because of where this might lead in terms of censorship. Now, Martin Bashir might very well have told a couple of porky pies to get an interview with Princess Diana. He might have falsified a document. It's not good.
Well, I don't think he did.
Do you not? Well, just before you come in on that.
I'll listen to you, but I don't think that was what got him the interview.
I'm not saying he might have. The point I was going to make is, whether he did or whether he didn't, it's apparent to me, I've read Morton's book, I read it years ago, I had Noel Bossum on my radio show, rest in peace Noel Bossum, for many years. I've known people who've been around the Diana story for years. It's apparent to me that Princess Diana was telling the truth to Martin Bashir, or what she believed to be the truth. So regardless of how Bashir ended up sitting in front of her, surrounded by cameras and sound men, the fact is she was telling the truth, and there seems to be a big movement against that, and that's something you're very concerned about, T.
Well, look, I think this is a reaction to a documentary that went out on ITV last year called The Revenge of a Princess.
Yeah.
It was a brilliant 2-hour-long documentary on ITV, which looked at that documentary, whatever it is, I suppose, well, 25 years on, the panorama film, and how it was made. And it was absolutely, in fact, I think there's only one of the parts of the two parts available anymore on YouTube or anywhere else I can find. But it was absolutely devastating. It was a look at how the princess most definitely did want to do the interview. She came willingly into Panorama. It wasn't any sort of con job by Martin Bashir. And who is Martin Bashir now? Well, he was the religious broadcasting chief at the BBC.
Until recently.
Means, for example, He was in charge until last week of things like Radio 3's Choral Evensong, you know, things like that, which we wouldn't get anywhere if we didn't get from the BBC and Radio 3. You know, he was a very influential guy, the Daily Service, things like that that they do on the BBC. Martin Bashir's in charge, and that he's been booted out now. But the amazing thing that happened over the weekend was this, you know, removal of Hall as well, who'd been Director General at the time, Tony Hall. Now, he was nothing to do with the BBC anymore. He was the director of the National Gallery. But it just so happens that Prince Charles is the patron of the National Gallery. So Charles is doing whatever he can to, I think, I would say it's a 25-year-old vendetta against anybody that supported his ex-wife, who, by the way, I believe absolutely 100% was murdered, assassinated in Paris. No doubt in my mind whatsoever about that, because there were various reasons for that, which we could go into if you want. But this, I think, that's going on now is a long-term vendetta that Charles has to get anybody who was involved in that, because the BBC at the time was far, far, far more professional and ballsy than it is now. It's now supine. Back then, they were prepared to dish the dirt on Charles, because that's what it really meant, that doing that interview.
Yeah, it did,
dish the dirt on Prince Charles. Of course, she has got no ability now to speak, you know, Diana, to give her side of this. And it seems that there's hardly anyone apart from Esther Ranson who came out at the weekend on the Mar show to give any kind of balance in this argument, because everyone is scared to death of having the royal family, you know, jump down their throats over this, Richie.
I'll tell you what was interesting, G. I'll tell you what was interesting about what's happened in recent weeks and the reaction of the media. And you talked there about the BBC, and I was going to jump on you and criticise you and argue with you about the BBC being better back then. I was going to argue with you. But when I think back...
Oh, it was.
I was just going to say, when I think back, only 18 months afterwards, the BBC ran a programme asking had she been murdered. And to its credit, it managed not to editorialise and left the programme open-ended. I can't imagine that happening in 2021. So I think back then it certainly was. Landmines for me, Noel Botham, I've interviewed Noel, God love him. I interviewed everybody around that, even some of the reporters who were in Paris at the time. And many people settled on this landmine thing, her persuading Bill Clinton to publicly say that he would support the outlawing of landmines. Then you have Keith Allen and others who came on programmes with me. You know these people as well. You've interviewed them. And they believe that the Duke of Edinburgh had some part in the murder of Princess Diana. It's we're never going to know now, are we, really?
Guess. I think we do know. And the way you find out, and the books to read are written by John Morgan. There's two main ones. I would say the short one is The Paris-London Connection, which is a very easy read, and it takes you through the main points. But then there's another one called How They Murdered Princess Diana by John Morgan, who is sadly no longer with us, the Australian investigative journalist. He explains everything. Really, you know, what he's done is he's gone through the three main bits of public evidence. There were, in fact, the police reports weren't public, but he got leaked copies of them from both Paris and France and London, the Scotland Yard one, and the Paget report, and also the transcripts of the inquest. So he had all of that stuff together. He put together the whole business, really, from start to finish. So basically what happened, there were people on high-powered motorbikes. Now, he's not entirely sure who they were. They could be French special forces, Israeli special forces, or even SAS on powerful motorbikes that were intimidating the car. The car tried to go faster than they were going, but obviously the motorbikes were faster. And then there was some sort of trigger mechanism on the front part of the car, which made it suddenly swerve one side and straight into a pillar. Now, Diana survived the crash. She was actually reasonably healthy. She'd scored, I think it's 13 out of 14 on the trauma scale. So there was no urgency to treat her, but she was put into an ambulance, taken to Saltpeter Hospital, and then she was effectively murdered by the people in the ambulance on the way. So that's what he has put together from all that evidence.
But he can't prove that, though. This is the problem.
Sorry?
He can't prove that. He suspects it, and he's got enough circumstantial evidence to lead him to report on it. But he can't prove it. That's the thing. I've heard similar stories. Noel said to me, again, God rest him, years ago, he felt that she was given somebody put a hand over her mouth and nostrils in the car and killed her there and then. That's what he said.
Well, she was operated on.
She was operated on in some way,
or injected with something in the ambulance. Yeah. Anyway, the point being, why? You mentioned quite correctly landmines. The other reason was she was about to announce her engagement to Dodi Fayed. Now, the idea of William and Harry having a Muslim, immediate Muslim stepfather, was totally out of the question as regards the royal family. They didn't want that to happen at all because of that Islamic influence there would immediately be on the royal family. So they were very, and that was, I think, the key thing. If you look at, I can't remember the guy's name. He used to work for, do the Scallywag paper. He put out a thing at the time, which I've still got a copy of, actually, which showed that they'd already booked a room to do a press conference to announce the engagement in London two or three days after she was killed. So this is why they didn't want, you know, didn't want her to announce that engagement.
Is there hard evidence that they had booked a press conference, her and Dodi? Is there hard evidence, T, that they booked a press conference?
It's a long time ago since I read it. I wish I could remember the name of the guy from Scallywag. He is, no longer with us, but that was put out. It's now disappeared off the internet. You can't find it anywhere.
Can I ask you this, Steve? What about the theory? Can I ask you this? Let me ask you. No, this is important. This is important. Can I ask you this? There are those who say that there was no way in hell that she was going to announce her engagement, that she wouldn't do that to her children, that any relationship she might have carried on with Dodi, she would have done it reasonably privately, or as privately as she possibly could. What do you say to that?
No chance, because she's a free spirit. She's not going to wreck her future on the rock of Prince Charles. No chance. And you know, she realised that he had a relationship with Camilla. He can go up and remarry her, and she's going to go and remarry somebody that loves her.
Yeah.
You know, that was the problem. She was in this loveless relationship. But back to the Bashir business. I mean, I've been absolutely disgusted to see the way that this has been so one-sidedly treated, and also even compared to the Savile scandal. Well, hang on a minute. Doing some really good investigative journalism, in other words, this amazing... In fact, this is one thing I want to tell you. Back in around about 98, I was invited up to a conference up at the Director General's suite in Broadcasting House, and I actually met a guy called Richard Eyre, who was the, this is, you know, just literally,
I think it'd be
98, some very, very shortly after that interview. And I think possibly around about the time that Diana died. And he explained to me that he said it was absolutely rivetingly exciting doing that, because we knew that we as the BBC were doing it in the public interest, giving Diana her voice, but we had to really tiptoe around the royal family, because we knew if they got a sniff at the fact that we were about to do this documentary. In other words, there was nothing in the Radio Times about it. It wasn't announced beforehand at all. They had to bring the camera crew into Kensington Palace to film it secretly. In fact, they even wrapped up all the camera equipment in used hi-fi boxes to disguise the fact of what it actually was when it went in, so that it wouldn't trigger a sort of security alert of some sort. And they got an absolute adrenaline rush, Richard Eyre and other people at the top of the BBC at the time, from doing it, because they knew this is what the BBC's here for, to do documentaries like this, and we're not going to allow the royal family, because the BBC's constituted under a royal charter, to shut this down. And also because the royal family did control the BBC via the chairman, Marmaduke Hussey, who was married to the Queen's chief lady-in-waiting. So they knew, if we're going to do this piece of public service broadcasting, we've got to make sure that the royal family don't get a whiff of it, because if they do, this documentary is never going to go to air. And so they did, I think, what is an absolutely brilliant bit of public service broadcasting in getting that out there.
Yeah, I agree. Looking back on it, looking at it with more experienced eyes, because I was a very, very young would-be broadcaster and producer back then. Looking at it now, yeah, they were absolutely right to go with it. Bashir didn't coerce her into saying anything. He didn't lead her in the interview. He was very inexperienced, but yet he didn't lead her, in any direction. She was pretty forthright with her views and what she wanted to say. So I totally endorse that, you know.
The other thing that's not come out, Richie, is that actually by forging these documents, these bank statements, he was going in the wrong direction. He was trying to get to her through her family, right? Thinking that her family was supporting her. Her family weren't. Most of her family were actually on the side of Charles and the royal family and the establishment, not on her side at all.
Yeah.
So he was wasting his time trying to go through the family to get to her, and he obviously got to her through other routes.
Here's a question for you.
She was absolutely 100% willing to do that.
No doubt, and you're right.
She was somehow coerced into it.
Is nonsense.
It's absolutely ridiculous.
Nonsense. Listen, there are ethics around our job. There are things you shouldn't do. Now, am I going to sit here and lie and say that I've not sometimes, well, not recently, but in the past, have I bent the truth a little bit to get an interview? I suppose the worst I've ever done over the years is tell stories about how large the audience is sometimes. I've invited people on, how big is your audience? And way back when I started out, I would indulge myself a little bit and say that I had more listeners than I actually had. But I understand why Bashir did it, and everything about the interview from then on in was good. Listen,
it's an important question of journalistic ethics.
Yeah.
But I call it Roger Cook syndrome, because if you're not going to con somebody, you're not going to have a journalistic sting in order to, I mean, basically the way it works is, I mean, I had to go through this several times in various undercover filming I did. And what you do is you have to go to your editor and you have to say, well, look, I want to use a technique which isn't a standard technique in order to get this interview or to get this piece of audio or video. And you have to justify it. So in other words, you have to show in a way, like a court case in a way. So you've got to show that there is evidence that this person, whoever they are, that you're targeting with a sting, has done something wrong or possibly criminal or whatever. And it's got to be, but the trouble is, as soon as you go to an editor nowadays with any information like that, they will pass it up the chain. It will get to, you know, whatever, security services or whatever, and the whole thing will be shut down before you've even started. So this is the problem, is that the bureaucracy has made it almost impossible to do anything like this ever again. The Roger Cook program, I'm sure you remember.
Oh, what a program.
And, you know, week after week, he was doing these journalistic things left, right, and center through central television. And they were the best, I mean, they were the best watched, the most popular current affairs TV journalism there's ever been.
It was brilliant, yeah.
And of course, the whole thing was shut down by Rupert Murdoch on the News of the World, because he was actually doing a brilliant job for the public, and they didn't want the broadcasters to do that.
No, they certainly did not. Before we talk about Belarus, and when we do, we'll only have about 5 or 6 minutes, was Diana's assassination ritualistic? Was it done in a way to signal to others in the hidden power structure that it had been done? Was it ritualistic? Was it done in that way?
Well, to be honest with you, I don't know.
No.
I don't think so particularly. I mean, it was the actual choice of the Alma Tunnel was, according to the ex-MI6 officer Richard Tomlinson, who swore an affidavit back at the time, he was saying that he'd seen plans to kill Slobodan Milosevic in a tunnel in a similar way. And he was rather shocked when he saw the way that Diana died, saying, you know, there would be vehicles around to coerce the vehicle to go faster, and then there'd be some sort of device to make it go sideways suddenly. And he, when he saw the way Diana had died, he immediately said, well, this is MI6 that have done this, and I've seen the plan that they didn't use against Milosevic. They've now used it against Diana.
MI6.
So I don't see it as a particularly ritualistic thing, no.
MI6, what about...
It was a practical assassination, Richie. This is how you kill people.
Do you know what? There are better ways of killing people. When I used to interview Noel, and I keep dropping Noel's name. I do miss Noel. He used to speak to me a lot when I was on radio in Spain, like you did. Lovely gentleman. When I used to speak to Noel, I used to say, well, there are better ways of assassinating somebody than sending guys to chase a very heavy armoured Mercedes. I drove a very similar Mercedes when I lived in Spain. I'm not suggesting now for a minute that I could afford a car like that. I was able to get one for less than £1,000, a very old one. It was just massive. I can't imagine trying to kill somebody like that. But look, we won't go down that road. I want to talk for a moment about, we can certainly get into this in the future because it's very important.
Just before we get off Diana, one of the most fascinating things that John Morgan explains is that Sherard Cowper-Coles, who's a Bilderberger and one of the directors now of BAE Systems, he was sent 2 weeks before to Paris in order to take over certain roles from the MI6 offices there, you know, the station in Paris. And he puts him down as the mastermind. So, you know, I think, you know, we on your show, we can name names. I think, Cowper Coles should be, you know, one of the people who's put in the dock and asked to answer questions about this, because where were you on the day? Who did you instruct to do X, Y, and Z? Because, of course, this is all, you know, he has protected himself by covering himself
in this
cloak of national security.
Yeah.
So you're never going to be able to ask another question at all about this.
It's nice that we name him on my show so that I can get sued for libel. That's lovely. Speaking of guys who ran operations, we could be here all night talking about George H.W. Bush, the only man in the world who didn't remember where he was on the day that John F. Kennedy was murdered. And that's because he was in Dallas overseeing the operation, my opinion. Now, we've got 6 minutes. Don't give me any guff now, Gosling. You're a radio presenter yourself. You're a radio presenter yourself, so you know we've got 6 minutes now. Tell me about this guy, this Roman Protasevich, who was allegedly kidnapped. He was taken off a flight that was diverted, a flight that was heading for Lithuania. The Belarusian authority sent up a fighter jet to force it to the ground, apparently because this guy has been very critical of the government. They've arrested him and his girlfriend. His family believes that he's been abused, he's been tortured. It looks pretty bad to me, T. The mainstream media is not wrong all the time. A broken clock is right twice a day. It looks like pretty bad behaviour by the Belarusians. What do you say?
Well, my union, the NUJ, has condemned it, and I can totally understand that.
Yeah.
You know, everyone's entitled to their point of view. First of all, the fighters didn't force it to the ground. The pilot was ordered to land, which he
over
was willingly doing by the military in Belarus. And the fighters were there to what we might call escort it. So, in other words, they had a little bit of, I suppose, when Protasevich is looking out of his window and he sees a MiG sitting there, immediately nervous. But look, you know, they are actually, they've used a little bit of trickery here, but they are entitled to do this sort of thing in their own airspace. I think this is immensely significant, Richie, because it shows me we had a month or so ago the request of Putin for the American ambassador to leave Moscow and go back to Washington. Now, that followed a month previously the Moscow ambassador to Washington being withdrawn. Now, this is a permanent state of affairs now. So there's no Russian ambassador in Washington and no American ambassador in Moscow anymore. This has never happened before.
Never.
Not even during the Russian Revolution, not during World War II, not during the Cuban Missile Crisis. This is immensely, immensely significant. The media is not talking about it at all. What it says to me is that the Russians, their intelligence services have picked up that the Americans and NATO generally are up to something this summer, and that they are sending a message to the world to say that whatever they're planning, they're obviously not telling us what they're planning something which is going to be devastating. Now, whether it's summer or autumn, God knows. But anyway, by withdrawing their ambassadors, they're saying, right, well, we're ready to fight you now. So they're not actually... I don't think they're pushing the fight. They're saying we're ready to respond to whatever you do. So this is the backdrop to which this is happening. And when we see Protasevich force his plane force to the ground, what the Russian intelligence service, they've still got a KGB in Belarus, so this is in conjunction, I imagine, with the FSB in Russia, is they have identified the ringleaders of the anti-democratic rallies that took place after the election in Belarus. And the way that Putin operates, I think, is extremely professional in terms of policing, right? So he identifies who the top people are who've been organizing political subversion in Belarus in this case, and he keeps a very close eye on them. And when they see an opportunity to apprehend him, he's the guy they get. They don't bother with anybody else, the low-hanging fruit. They get the top guy, right? So this guy, he's only 23 years old. So he was 22, I think, when all this kicked off. A very young person, a young hothead recruited by the Western intelligence services, very much like Victoria Nuland was paying her billions to get ferment dissent and demonstrations in Ukraine back in 2014, 2015, etc. And they decided, right, if we get this guy, it's going to send a clear message to everybody else who knows what his role was, that this is what happens if you try and organize subversion in Belarus or any other country which is under the Russian sphere of influence in Eastern Europe. And this is, I think, a very clear message to the West. There's no more messing about at all. And this is, I think, all relating to this breakdown in diplomatic relations between between Moscow and Washington.
Very interesting analysis there. If look, the guy's a journalist. Regardless of whether what he does is deemed to be subversive, it's wrong. It's absolutely wrong to be kidnapping a journalist and his girlfriend. And if he has had his nose broken and been beaten up, it's outrageous.
No, it's not. If he's, there's a warrant out for this guy's arrest in Belarus. If he's in the Belarus airspace, they're quite within their rights to arrest him, particularly if he is the main instigator and he's trying to avoid being in the country so he doesn't get arrested. If he flies over the country, whoopsie-daisy, matey, you just made a big mistake there.
But it is an authoritarian. Hang on. Belarus, like it or lump it, like Russia, is an authoritarian setup. Listen, I've been quite happy with Vladimir. Let me finish. I've been very.
Democracy.
Hang on. I've been very complimentary, I suppose, over the years, in recent years, about the Putin administration's approach to Syria, and which I think has been hugely important. I believe Russia does as much and as little. It does no more in terms of espionage than anybody else. When I hear these stories about Russia trying to interfere in elections here and in America, I laugh my ass off. It's ridiculous. It's the pot calling the kettle black and all of that. But I take a more rounded and a more broad view of Putin. Putin's a gangster. He's an absolute gangster, Vladimir Putin. He used the Sochi Olympics to basically spread hundreds of millions of euro around his own bank accounts and the bank accounts of his friends. I have no doubt he's been involved in killing people over the years, a former KGB agent. And he's basically been running Russia for years and years and years with little opposition. Whatever way you describe him, it's an authoritarian setup. It's the same in Belarus.
No, you're wrong. You're absolutely wrong, Richie.
You will prove me wrong then.
The reason you're wrong is because Putin is extremely popular in Russia. He has no trouble winning genuine elections. And if you talk to people on the street, as we did when I was there, they think he's great. They think, you know what, one of the people I was chatting with was saying, he's a good manager. We can see it all over this country. The roads are being improved. The cities are improving. Everything is on the up. If you go to Moscow today, it's a bit like the 1960s London, Carnaby Street. The young people are thriving. There's loads of job opportunities over there. We don't see any of this on the media over here.
But he's had his opponents killed over the years. He kills his opponents, too.
Yes, he's a gangster. Yes, he's a gangster.
I know.
All these leaders are gangsters.
But he's all right.
But he's made it absolutely clear to the financial elite. Let me get this point out.
Okay.
Made it very clear to the financial elite and the oligarchy that you can do your gangster stuff in Russia, whatever you want to do, but you come anywhere near the Kremlin, soon as you touch politics in this country, I'm going to chop your fingers off.
That makes him even worse.
You're either going to be arrested or you're going to be deported.
That makes him even worse. That makes him even worse. That makes him even worse. Okay, gangsters, you can fuck up, you can fuck Russia, you can rob and pillage and plunder Mother Russia all you want, just don't come near the Kremlin and we'll be okay.
Listen, we're far worse here. We have gangsters running the show.
I agree.
But he's made sure that the financial elite in Russia can do the stuff that they need to do, but as soon as they start encroaching on the Kremlin, which is, you know, is running the country and running it very well these days, according to the Russians themselves, very popular leader, genuinely popular, you know, far more than our Western leaders and European leaders who are mostly despised by the population. You know, when it comes to an election here, we have to choose between the worst of three
absolute
or four
garbage,
or one or two, you know.
Yeah, I give you that.
He is popular. I'm sorry, you can't get away from the fact that Putin is popular genuinely amongst the Russian population. He is.
You've been there and I haven't, so I'm going to give you the final word on that. That was the final word. Mwinga says on Twitter, very good, get Tony back for an hour soon to talk about Diana. Let's do that. We can talk about Diana and other high-profile assassinations. It'll give both of us a nice break from talking about coronavirus. Thanks as always, mate, for coming on. Thisweek.org.uk, Friday, the politics show, Tony Gosling and a cast of thousands. If you want to hear doctors, scientists, if you want to hear academics, if you want to hear politicians that you don't hear on the BBC and on Sky News, you will hear them on Tony's programme. Top man, T, thanks for coming on again today, mate.
God bless. Thank you.
As always, buddy, thank you. Tony Gosling with the last word there on Vladimir Putin. You're with the Richie Allen Radio Show, which is live from Salford.